Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry! These July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Merkle Media.
I guess it's time to go back in time.
Are you telling me you built a time machine? Out of a DeLorean?
Time is but a stubborn illusion.
I have a lot of memories of the past.
People are time traveling within themselves.
Time travel is possible.
Are you willing to sacrifice your life?
They're staying in the shadows. It's called probing. Make sure things are all clear.
Clear for what?
For the rest of the world.
You guys hear that?
Okay, I'll reload it.
Welcome to the show, everybody. I am your host, Tony Merkle, and I am really glad that you're here, and I am really glad to be here. If you're a member on the website, feel free to go check out the new episode I put up this week called Mandalay Bay, The Inside Story. It is an interview that I did with a guy named Alika, and we discuss how the whole Mandalay Bay episode came together. He actually knew a lot of people that were there, and he talks about how that happened and how he got in touch with all these people. It's a really good story. So if you guys are members, go ahead and check it out. And if you're not a member, feel free to think about becoming a member. All you have to do is go to the website, hit the membership section, and you can sign up there. I want to say thank you to everybody who sent me emails this week just wishing me well and telling me you're praying for me from last week's encounter story that I shared with the Warlock. It means a lot to me to know you guys are out there taking care of business and just praying for me and wishing me well. It really meant a lot, the response that I got from everybody. It was actually overwhelming. I didn't expect to get that kind of response. In fact, I didn't think anybody would really give a crap about my encounter story. So it really actually meant a lot to me to know that you guys cared and just wanted to let me know. So thank you very much, and I really appreciate that. Now, this week's show, we have Gary Wayne coming on. Gary Wayne is actually the author of the Genesis 6 Conspiracy, and many of you have actually reached out to me asking me to get Gary Wayne on the show, and so this week is your week. Gary, how are you?
I'm doing excellent and so happy to be here and looking forward to working with you today on the show and talking all things giants. So
yes.
I love the subject. I love everything it connects into it. So it's going to be a good show, I think.
Absolutely. Well, Gary, let's just start off because there's a lot of people out there that may not know who you are or what this Nephilim giant thing is. So you did write a book. It's called Genesis 6 Conspiracy. And how did that book all come about for you?
Well, initially, I wasn't looking to be an author, and I'm more of a history buff and a mythology buff and a prophecy buff. And so what I did was, you know, with my passion in reading and history and mythology and prophecy, as I was logging all the different prophecy narratives in the Bible and filing them to maybe dig deeper, connect them all together. At some point in time, you run across these giants in Genesis 6, and they come up after the flood, and they come up in the New Testament, and there's demons, and there's fallen angels. And what I thought I would do for my first book was write a short book that would connect somehow the giants of Genesis 6 to end time prophecy and see whether or not I had, you know, enough skills to write a book. Could I get published, and would it sell? What happened along the way is I did even more research into it, it kept opening up more doors. And so when I started looking and bringing in other mythologies, historical accounts, and then got into other religions, and all of this led me into secret societies and all of the things that they wrote about, you know, it turned from probably the longest book I'll ever write from the intention of writing a short book just to see whether or not I could get published. So it went from, you know, say over 20 some odd years of research and prophecy to write my first book, and then another over 10 years to write the book with all the additional research from the doors that were opening.
Yeah, I know this book is extremely long, but the chapters aren't that bad. The average chapter is what, about 10 pages, I'd say?
Not even that, because it's an 800-page book. There's 98 chapters plus a preface and a epilogue, and there's over 120 pages of footnotes and endnotes, I should say, because I wanted people to verify my research if they didn't believe what I was saying. So each chapter will average, say, 6 to 7 pages, and each chapter is a mini story that leads into the next chapter and will keep coming up as the book unfolds, so that you can read it in pieces and chunks and you can go back and reread a chapter, and it's not like a 30-page chapter or something like that.
Yeah, I kind of look at it the same way as when you're reading the Bible, you really can't sit down and read the Bible in one shot. And it's like with your book, you can't really sit down and read it all in one shot and comprehend it all.
Not only is it too long to do that, but every chapter is absolutely loaded with information from chapter 1 right through chapter 98, and it just keeps coming at you. So literally, you're going to get overwhelmed, and you might actually start popping some brain cells if you're trying to take too much of it in at one time. So,
absolutely. Well, before this whole thing came about as far as your book and everything, and you were doing all this research, what were your first thoughts about the Nephilim? Like, what was some of your assumptions about these things?
Well, you know, at first when you come across the concept, you think, well, that's what is this talk about giants in Genesis 6? And then you don't really get any detail with it. Not a lot of detail anyways. And then you have giants sort of coming up after the flood and, you know, in more numbers, but most people don't recognize some of the peoples that are being talked about as giants. So, you know, you kind of think about, well, it's just kind of odd that this is in the Bible. And so my thoughts on it were is, giants not this normal sort of thing, right? This is not talking about somebody that is 7 feet tall or 6 feet tall and is extra tall like King Saul was, where he was a head and his shoulders above the rest of the Israelites. This is about monstrous-sized giants. These are, you know, even Goliath, if you take him on his cubit count as a common cubit, as it's recorded in the Bibles, he'll come out to, you know, over 9 feet tall, almost 10. And if you take it as a royal cubit at 21 inches versus the common at 18, he'd be closer to 11 feet. And he's not as big as King Og is who, you know, sleeps on a bed using similar measurements. He's going to be somewhere between, you know, 13 and 15 feet tall based on the size of the bed. And we understand that these monsters were even bigger in the first generations and before that. So we don't know how big they are. And there's people think that the Book of Enoch is saying that they're going to be 450 feet tall based on somehow trying to figure out what an L is, which nobody knows. I think that's probably not accurate, but who knows? It's an apocryphal book. But they were very large, and it's sort of like most people will settle somewhere between 20 and 40 feet. And Christian scholars will back that up by saying, you know, in the book of Amos, Amos 2, that Amorites were as tall as the cedars in Lebanon. And these were the giant trees of Lebanon, and they grew 35 to 50 feet tall. So that's kind of where that upper end comes from.
That's incredible. I mean, these things must have been absolutely huge, and like not just tall, but wide too. I mean, when you're talking about 20 feet or more, I mean, you got to account for the girth of these things. So you hear these stories of, you know, these giants running through fields, like the Native American stories of the giants running through field and picking up buffalo and running away with them and stuff. I mean, these things must have been absolutely massive.
They were, and they weren't just tall. They were incredibly muscular and wide. So typically, as you understand it, you have a height to width ratio of a human as being 3 to 1, but it's 2 to 1 when it comes to the giants. And it doesn't matter whether or not you're talking about the Nephilim from the Bible or the Titans from Greek mythology or the Anunnaki from Sumerian mythology or the Tuatha De Danann out of Irish mythology or Zibelba out of the Kisha Maya or the Daitya and the Asuras and the Danua out of Chinese mythology or the Myosi out of Chinese mythology. They all have almost identical accounts for these monsters, not only as being tall but extraordinarily wide, but also being very dexterous with both their hands and their feet, which help make them these great warriors. And that's just not the only thing that would separate these from the average human, who would have been probably somewhere around 5 feet to 5.5 feet at that time.
Yeah, that's incredible. So, I mean, you're thinking if it's 20 feet tall, you're about 10 feet wide, and that's huge. I mean, I come from a basketball background, and a basketball hoop is 10 feet tall, and you know, most people can't even jump and touch a rim on a backboard. And you're talking about that's the width of these things. That's incredible.
Yeah, I mean these were just not tall people, and that's kind of the biggest thing. And even, you know, even in the Roman times, you get documentation of giants that are 10 feet and 11 feet tall. And you've got and those were the ones I just referred to are Pasio and Secundilia in the time of Augustus, I'm confusing it with a church patriarch, and Claudius. And then there's also the Thracian recorded at being over 9 feet tall. So this is recorded all the way throughout history. And Josephus says that not only were they monstrous, but their whole engineering in terms of their bone structure was completely different than that of a human, which they would have to be because of the size of the weight. Otherwise, they'd be sideshow freaks and they wouldn't be these great warriors. And he goes on to say that they are of such a wonder that they were on public display for people to come look at in the cities up to his time. So these things were absolutely monstrous, but there's more to it than that. I mean, not only were they monstrous, but their eyes are said to have glowed because they were called the Shining Ones. And wow. Just as their parents, the seraphim angels or the watchers in the Christian account, as opposed to the gods of the other religions and mythologies and legends around the world, the seraphim were a viper, fiery angel, and their offspring looked just like them. And, you know, you get into some non-Christian descriptions, like in some of the Gnostic Gospels and the origins of the world, they describe these giants as serpent-like beings. And so they're referred to as having long, narrow faces and prominent cheekbones and elongated jawbones and slanted eyes and thin lips. And I think if you look at, you know, a couple thousand years after they're first created and look at King Akhenaten, whose statue is in all of the King Tut museums as they go on tour, you're going to see this extended chin, these high cheekbones, these slanted eyes, and this elongated skull. And so even after that long period of time, they had this viper look just like their parents. So these were incredibly frightening, large, and scary beings that looked just like their parents, the Seraphim Angels or the Watchers or the Gregorius, some people will call them, or the Anunnaki from heaven, or the Olympian gods like Zeus, who would copulate with human females. Because, again, people probably don't understand that the word demigod, which the Nephilim were considered and are considered as in the other religions and mythologies around the world, the definition of a hero or a demigod is basically the offspring of a god and a human female. So when we talk about heroes and heroes of old or men of renown or superheroes of today, which is just another reflection of that ancient history, we're talking about beings that had took on significant traits of their parents in all cultures, all continents, all religions around the world.
Yeah, so, I mean, you're talking about these things were real-life monsters, in a sense. I mean, compared to what we are as human beings, you look at these things, and they weren't human. And just by looking at them, you knew they weren't human. They weren't just oversized people. And you hinted on it earlier throughout your talk here. How did these things actually come about? Now, I know there's different stories behind it all. There's the Christian perspective in the Bible, and then there's other mythologies. But what would you say about how these things actually came about?
Well, I think the creation of them, there are some varying stories in terms of, you know, like say in Central America, where the giants are created from clay or from rocks. But the large majority of them have the same story. So in the Bible, in Genesis 6, where you have the account of the giants being created, the Nephilim, is you have the sons of God, who are angels. They go to human females, and they take any wives they choose. And in the book of Enoch, which is apocryphal, it lists 200 of them on Mount Hermon where this takes place. But this doesn't mean that it doesn't take place more than just on Mount Hermon. And so the offspring of taking these wives produces these immortal giants. And that's why in Genesis 6, you have God limiting the lifespan of these mortals to, or these demigods to 120 years, just as that will also take in humankind as sort of collateral damage as a consequence. And over a few generations, this will start to take place. But the first generation receives this immortal spirit. And so these are the giants that don't go to sleep. And these are the giants that when their bodies die out, their spirit doesn't go to sleep and they're not permitted to go into heaven. And so these become the demon spirits that the New Testament talks about. Now, we have a very similar story that goes on in Greek mythology, which most people will understand, as opposed to if I talk about the Myosi or the Daiteia and maybe heroes and giants that they don't know the names of and which culture. So we'll talk about Atlantis, because that comes right out of Greek mythology, and with the god who is the brother of Zeus, Poseidon, and he takes his first wife as by the name of Clymene, and has sex with her and produces 10 Titan kings, Atlas being one of them, and Atlas being king over the island continent of Atlantis. But the other 9, because there's 5 sets of twins, they're going to rule over the other 10 nations of the Atlantean Empire in the antediluvian world. So it's the identical same story. And you have this told over and over and over in all the other cultures.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off 2 or more select major appliances. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9, selection varies by location while supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off 2 or more select major appliances. Plus, get 3 Scott's Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Now, I know I've had people reach out to me and want to talk about the Nephilim. And one thing they always bring up to me is that angels aren't allowed to marry. And the only thing, and I'm not, you know, the brightest bulb around, but the way I always looked at it was, you know, just because they're not allowed to marry doesn't mean they can't have sex. I mean, there's in the Bible, you see angels taking on the form of human beings to the point that you wouldn't even know they were angels. So that means they actually, you know, looked like human beings at some point. Is that the right way to look at it?
Yeah, I would phrase it that way. And Matthew 22, which is what they're referring to, only talks about they don't have wives in heaven and thus have and don't have a sex. And I think that's all true. They're immortal beings, so they don't have to reproduce. And they're created in great numbers. And if we take Revelation 5, as I believe it is, as the number that was created, 10,000 times 10,000, that's 100 million. So there's a lot of them. They don't need to recreate because they're immortal. But humans need to reproduce after the Garden of Eden because they're not immortal, and otherwise they would go extinct. But it only says in Matthew that this is not permitted in heaven. Doesn't mean that they're not able to do so in the physical world, which is different than the heavenly spiritual dimension world, and that they somehow seemingly can take a different shape in this world and any sex that they choose in this world as well. So they could become a male god or a female goddess. And that's how other religions would suggest that the lower gods of the pantheon are created is between two fallen angels procreating in the physical world with the physical form that they take to produce lower male and female gods. And when these gods produce with human females, they produce the demigods or the titans or the giants. And this is a common sort of understanding in the Bible when we look at how many different forms that the angels will take. Just as the angel Satan, as we know him, is known as a dragon and a serpent, which is, you know, kind of the same thing. But he can also seemingly take other forms as he's in this world as well. And we see, as you said, men, we see these great giant shining beings. We have many different kinds of angels, and they seem to have this changeling ability. And we get that in not from the Bible account as an exact doctrine, but just examples thereof. But if you were to go into Jewish mysticism or other apocryphal books, you get a very clear understanding that they have this changeling capability. And we only have that from example. But in Jude 1:6, where it talks about these angels who left their habitat or habitation to violate these crimes against creation, the word habitation comes from the word oikaterion, which means a dwelling place for a spirit. So they left their dwelling place for their spirit, and they need another dwelling place for their spirit in this realm. And we see that same word only used one other time in Corinthians 5, where it's talking about the same sort of subject, only in this manner you're talking about sort of the clothes and the body of the heavens and the body of the earthly realm. So I think they have to take a form if they want to interact with this world, and that they have that ability to do so. But then they also seemingly are subject to the corruptions of this world and the temptations thereof.
Okay. So you mentioned about this earlier, about some of the dead Nephilim became what we would call demons. If I remember correctly, that came out of Enoch, right?
Typically, Enoch talks about that in detail, yes. But you can make the case biblically as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one thing that I would like to kind of go into a little bit, because I have the Book of Enoch here at home, and I've been reading through it and stuff. And when I talk to, you know, your traditional Christian community, they often question, you know, why I would read the Book of Enoch. Could you maybe lead to that, you know, why it's important to understand extra canonical books?
Yeah, I think it's important so that you get a better context as to what's going on. And I want to qualify for, you know, any Christians that might be listening is that I measure everything that I read in outside biblical sources against what it says in the Bible. And so I want to make sure that I'm not adding something in that the Bible doesn't say. So reading the book of Enoch, I think, gives incredible, extraordinary context, but it's not in the biblical canon. And I think one needs to be careful with it, because it may have been, it may not be the original book of Enoch that's referred to in Jude. So even though that verse is in this book, we don't know whether it's been corrupted. And the thing we have to be careful of with the book of Enoch, if you're a Christian, even though I love how closely it runs to the Bible, it does have some corruptions in it. And it's a typical MO of the Freemasons and the Gnostics to put their corruptions and their markers into these kinds of books. And in this case, the book is first discovered by Alexander Bruce, who is both a Gnostic and a Freemason. And so therefore you need to, you know, have your flags up to make sure everything is legitimate. So, and some of the corruptions that might be in the book would be things like the angels actually building the ark as opposed to Noah building the ark. And typically would be, you would have angels or gods warning humans and giants and other traditions and gospels of the flood that's coming, as opposed to God. And that's what Enoch talks about. You've got Enoch in there being 500 years old and 550 years old. And so I wonder whether or not that's a corruption, or this is a book of Enoch, son of Cain, because there's two Enochs in the Bible. There's Enoch, son of Cain, and Enoch, son of Jared of the Seth line. And it's Enoch, son of Seth, that everybody likes to attribute this book to, but he was taken to heaven at 365 years old. And so he wouldn't have been 500. And then there's several other smaller corruptions, but on a 97% rule or larger, it runs very, very consistent with what the Bible says. And then there's a whole bunch of other debate on the book of Enoch as to when it was written and how many different authors may have contributed to writing it, and they say as many as four. So I think it's one of the best apocryphal books out there, but you do want to be careful with it.
Sure. And, you know, you mentioned about how it said the angels helping or actually building the ark. And I know that one movie with Russell Crowe came out a few years back that actually showed just that, angels helping to build the ark. I'm assuming they probably got it from the book of Enoch, that idea.
That idea, well, that's a Gnostic idea as well. So,
okay.
In that whole movie, you're seeing a lot of Gnostic doctrine being overlaid on it, including Tubal Cain being on the ark, right?
Yes.
And Tubal Cain, again, is a descendant of Cain and a descendant of Enoch, son of Cain, just as, you know, Lamech is, and there's two Lamechs, just as Nama is, and Jubal and Jubal. And these characters are all patriarchs of Freemasonry and the ancient Masonic and Rosicrucian organizations. So there's, you have to watch the corruptions that they put in. And if anybody watched that movie, they're going to say, that's really quite a different story than what I read in the Bible. And
yeah.
So it, directionally, it has similarities, but it's not the same story. And that's a kind of a constant thing, because they're trying to put in their ideas of what happened in the flood. And so if you look at the Epic of Gilgamesh, for example, this is a story that's being told by a giant who is two-thirds god and one-third human, which is Gilgamesh, and who in Enoch Book of Giants on 4Q 531 to 535 is also recorded before the flood. So we're not sure whether or not he's a surviving antediluvian giant or he's recreated after the flood. And he's talking to Enkidu or Enkidu, depending on which translation that you're referring to, who is also two-thirds god and one-third human, and is created after the flood as, I guess, likely a second incursion to offset the evilness and the tyrant nature of Gilgamesh. And he's telling him the story about Upnut Pishtin, or Zayazudra, again, different translations, different names, who is the archetypical Nephilim, two-thirds God, one-third human, and so his whole family that is on the ark that survives. So they have a very, very strong tradition in their beliefs, where I'm going with this, of giants surviving the flood by being warned by angels as opposed to God, just as the Book of Enoch suggests, and that they also survived on the ark. Now, this is also used to slander and diminish the biblical account as being plagiarized from the Epic of Gilgamesh because they've got records that are older than it. And that would, and all that means to me is they're just older records. But they're distinctly different accounts. They're accounts of the same catastrophe, but one is about human survival, and one is about giant and Nephilim survival, in this case, Anunnaki. And all the macro is similar, but the details are completely different. And if you get into Greek mythology as another reference for the listeners, is you have Deucalion and Pyrrha, or Nerea, depending on which version that you're looking at, as the wife surviving the flood. And Deucalion is the son of Prometheus. And Prometheus is either a god or a demigod, Titan Nephilim. And either way, that makes Deucalion a Nephilim. And so this is, again, another giant survival story. And they're all over the world, these giant survival stories, on arcs, climbing the top of mountains, inside the earth, off-world, as in Emmaus-Seth, that's in one of the Gnostic Gospels, and on and on and on and on, that these giants did survive the flood. And what's interesting at all about that, and some Christians may find surprising, is these giants show up after the flood, and we're not specifically told how.
Right. And that was actually my next thing I wanted to bring up, was the fact that these things did survive the flood. And we see in Numbers 13:33 is, a very popular example about how they talked about seeing the Nephilim. Do you have any insight as to how maybe these things did, survive according to maybe the Bible? I know the Bible doesn't really go into that, but what are your thoughts on that totally?
Yeah, there's several different theories on that. And let me preface it by what you're talking about in Numbers 13, where it says the descendants of Anak, or the Anakim, are the descendants of giants. If you take giants back to the Hebrew word, it's going to say Nephilim, just as it says Nephilim in Genesis 6:4 when it says giants. And Nephilim's only used in the Hebrew three times, once in Genesis 6:4 and twice in Numbers 13. And then if you go to Deuteronomy 2, and there are other chapters, but I'll give one for the show. It talks about Anakim, or the Anak, Emin, other giant races that are called Rephaim and included as Rephaim. So Anakim are included as Rephaim. So if you take that lineage back, because in Numbers 13 it says, the Anakim are the descendants of Nephilim, that means all of these giants. It goes Anakim, Rephaim, back to Nephilim, that they survived the flood. So we get a number of choices as to how that can happen. One that a lot of writers will talk about is what I call somehow on the ark theory, and it includes a number of different ways, one being as what the Gnostics believe, that either Og or Tubal-Cain or other giants somehow stowed away on the flood, or hung on to the outside ropes. Other accounts and other versions would suggest that all of the people on the ark were giants. Some would say that just some of the brothers are giants, like Ham. Some of them say all of them are. So there's many different variations on that. And some Christians people will say on that theory is that the wives, who we don't know who the lineage are, might have the DNA of the giants. And that's how, after intermarrying, they reproduce through that DNA that's in their genes, giants after the flood. Except that these giant nations that I've been talking about, and there's the Abim and the Zamzuzim and on and on and on, the Horim, none of these giants go back to the Table of Nations in First Chronicles or Genesis, which lists all of the descendants that made the nations and the nations thereof that descend from Noah. They're not listed there. They have no genealogy back to the Table of Nations, so they come out of nowhere. So when they say that they intermarried with the Cainites, you know, the ones that carried the DNA, and they produce giants like the Hittites and things like that, and the Amorites. That's where the giants come from. That doesn't quite make sense to me, because we know those descendants have a genealogy back to the Table of Nations, but not these other nations. So they don't come from the Canaanites. Now, the second theory is on the ark, on an ark, or being helped by angels somehow. And that could be climbing to a mountain, several arcs around the world, taken off world in the earth. So somehow by the angels, and likely on an ark, is the second one. It would be a parallel account that would happen in more than one civilization around the world, because in most other accounts, and the Bible doesn't tell us how many civilizations there were, there's anywhere from 4 to 9. Typically, the average is 4 or 7, but in some occasions, you're seeing 9 in other accounts. And so the third way of doing it would be a second incursion. And what I mean by that is that fallen angels after the flood went to human beings and violated the laws of creation a second time, this time by spite and as opposed to passion. And the reason why I say that is because the angels that violated the laws of creation before the flood were locked into the abyss for their crimes. So these would be the angels that weren't a passion before, and as many as a third of the angels rebelled, according to Revelations. Others would have done the same afterwards to create the giants, and then they would presumably be locked away in the abyss as well. So those are kind of the ways that I would say that it could happen. And one of the reasons why I like to use the Epic of Gilgamesh is it gives both on an ark with giants, and you have second violations with the creation of Enkidu for sure, and possibly Gilgamesh.
Yeah, that's kind of makes sense to me too. I mean, like, when I look at the whole situation, I think about how the whole spite thing and the second incursion of these things, which kind of leads me to this next thought here, because that's kind of the idea that I think about too, that these things, they did it again. And with that thought in mind, do you think that these things are still around today? Because if they were around post-flood, what would have made them go extinct to this point?
Yeah, and I just wanted to sort of underline that I missed before, is to go along with why, and that's my more favored theory, is that there was a second incursion. And I like to back things up biblically, even though sometimes you have to speculate. So
sure.
Back in Genesis 6, what it clearly says is after, you know, they chose the wives, in 6:4, it says there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, and they bare children unto them, the same mighty men which were of old and men of renown. So it clearly says, in those days and also after that. So does that mean after the first incursion and still in the antediluvian epoch, or again after the flood? We don't know, but that's the closest thing I can say as to backing up a second incursion. Whereas the other ones, I have to rely on other accounts from other religions and legends to make the case, like the Epic of Gilgamesh. And then the other thing that, you know, people will point to from a Christian perspective is that, you know, God destroyed all of the humans and all of the flesh of the earth with the flood. Well, I would also note that in Genesis 6:7 and Genesis 7:4, what it clearly says is he destroyed everything he created. These beings were created by rebellious fallen angels or gods from another perspective.
Wow.
And human females, right? So if you want to get totally technical on that, you have to also take that into account. And that leaves sort of open the door that there's a possibility. But what we do know is the Bible clearly records these people coming out of nowhere.
Yes.
So somehow they show up.
Right. And that's the thing. I mean, like you said, they're clearly there post-flood, And that's some great insight. I've never heard anybody say that before. That's some really great insight. Now, coming back to that, do you think that these things could be around today? Because I do hear stories of people saying, for instance, I know I've heard people saying that they've seen what they call, they don't call them Nephilim. These people call them some kind of mountain giant. And I know there's been sightings of these things in Montana and North California and other areas, but those are two areas within the United States that people say they've seen these things where they say they look like human beings, but they're a lot bigger, 18, 20 feet tall. And also a description is that they have like tusks coming out of their mouth, which I can only imagine are like some kind of fangs or something. I don't know. Have you ever heard of that?
Not the tusks. No, I've not heard that. And I've not heard them being of quite that size. Did those accounts, do you recall, did it say whether or not they had red hair or not?
You know, I can't remember because I hear so many stories of the red hair giants in America.
Yeah, so most of the grave sites that we get with these giants that have been dug up and recorded in newspapers, and there's an incredible amount of newspaper clippings from about 1850 to about 1950, recording these giants, they would be found with, if there's hair left, they would have red hair, just as the Peruvian skulls that are being dug out today and excavated have red hair. And the reason why that's important is from the Middle Eastern giants, as we understand it, and in the Greek culture as well, and also in the Kisha Maya, as they record these antediluvian giants, they had two colors of hair. They had red hair with hazel eyes or green eyes, and or blonde hair and blue eyes. Now, if you get into other accounts around the world, they had different skin color because these ones are all white. And if they were created all around the world, they would have, you know, different skin color. That's why I ask about the hair. But we do have lots of newspaper accountings of excavations that all went to the Smithsonian between that time frame that I had talked about. And I regularly post those newspaper articles on my Facebook wall just to sort of keep underlining that there have been giants discovered. They're just not 18 feet tall. They're going to range from 7 feet tall to 12 feet tall. But still, those are very, very large beings, especially when you're considering anything that's over 9 feet.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I know a lot of times people talk about the Matthew 24, I believe it's verse 37, where Jesus said that, so as it was in the days of Noah, so will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Now, with that idea in mind, do you lend credit to that verse as to saying that Nephilim could return in the end times?
Yeah, I think we have to be open to that possibility. And I know a lot of people say that doesn't refer to the Nephilim. It refers to the time, to the days of Noah, that his second coming in the end time will be like the days of Noah. And if that's the case, you have to consider his life before the flood and 350 years after the flood. So that will include some infamous events like Babel and Sodom and Gomorrah. And all of those were also touched by the same polytheist religion that grew up around the giants through the seven sacred sciences and the descendants of Cain and the mystical religions and the secret societies they created thereof. And for the record, people may not realize it, but the Masonic Society believe they were created at that same time by the patriarchs of Cain to create their secret societies. And so I just kind of lost my train of thought there on what we were talking about when I got on the seven sacred sciences.
No, it's I had asked you about the numbers or Matthew 24:37 scenario where people reference that as the end times when the Nephilim come back.
Yes. So when you consider that this was the age of the giants, one has to be open to that possibility. And I think, I know a lot of people might disagree with that, that it's just that people were marrying and going on day to day. That will be part of it as well, because there will be a lot of people caught off guard with the deceptions that are coming. But, you know, if you look at Daniel 2:43 and the metallic dynasties, that the Nephilim control these dynasties. So let me backpedal a little bit. The Nephilim giants usurp the kingships both before and after the flood. and they create royal bloodlines and descendants and dynasties thereof, and continue to intermarry as much as they can to keep their bloodlines as pure as possible. And out of these comes the metallic dynasties of Daniel 2, which are going to be Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, and the end time Roman Empire, which is iron and clay. And so you've got gold, silver, bronze, iron, and clay as the metallic empires. And in Daniel 2:43, it clearly says in the King James Version Bible that these empires and their descendants are going to intermix in with the seed of humankind. So we have these bloodlines that are the royal families that have been keeping their genealogies all the way back into prehistory that are going to affect the end time, at least from a descendant perspective. So the other question gets to be is are we going to see a little recreation of new giants, or were other ones surviving in mountains and things as other mythologies and mythoses go? Possibly, but no matter what, it's my belief that Nephilim somehow, some way are going to impact the end time and control the 10 groups of nations or the 10 empires or the 10 spheres of influence or the 10 trading blocks that are going to be assembled for the end time world government.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location while supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Yeah, and I mean, when it comes to this whole idea of Nephilim at least coming back around in the end times, maybe they say you don't believe they're existing today, that's fine. But the idea of Nephilim coming into existence again, I mean, if you just pause and think about the technology that they have today, I mean, it's not far-fetched. I was doing a delivery a couple weeks ago, and I was delivering to this place where they sell caskets, and I started talking to the owner. He's an older guy, real older. I mean, he's in his 80s, close to 90s. And he was telling me how he was an engineer for the United States military back in the 60s or 50s, and he had top secret clearance, and he was doing a lot of side projects for them, top secret stuff. And he said that the technology that we have today, they had back in the 60s. He knows because he was working on it. He said, so he can't imagine what kind of technology they have today that we don't know about. And I asked him to come on the show, and he's like, no, I don't, not about that stuff. I just like talking about what I used to be involved in and stuff. But it was a really interesting conversation with him, and kind of really hit me hard because I started thinking, what kind of technology do we have today? And would it be possible to bring back some kind of ancient form of giants? Have you ever heard anybody talk about that stuff before?
Yeah, and I talk about it quite regularly.
Yeah.
So, again, if we look at that concept, the end time that Jesus talks about is going to be like the days of Noah. And we take that to a little bit larger, like as in all of the days of Noah. And I mentioned the seven sacred sciences and their creation of the mystery religions. This comes from the development of these sciences that these Gnostic religions and secret societies believe Adam was taught in Eden. And after Eden, Adam teaches that to both Abel and Cain. Abel gets murdered by Cain. Cain gets ostracized. And then Adam teaches it to Seth, who continues to practice it in a way that's going to honor God. But Cain goes a completely different direction and develops these sciences in a way that's not going to honor God, is going to lead people away from God, is going to not give credit for anything and is going to honor his new pantheon of gods. And he develops these technologies with the help of fallen angels. And the fallen angels will also provide, and this is recorded in all religions and mythologies around the world, additional knowledge from heaven that is used as an accelerator to the seven sacred sciences to take it to a technology that is probably greater than what we have today. And the reason why I say that is because if we're not in the end time yet, we may be close, but we're not there yet, then that means that the technology that we're having is still developing, and that the ancient epoch, which was destroyed by the first apocalypse by fire, had a greater technology because we're not in the end time yet. And if that's the case, then you can imagine all sorts of DNA manipulation. You can imagine all sorts of genome manipulation. You can imagine all sorts of fabulous beings that we're about to create, and all of the mythologies that are recorded around the world, whether or not you're talking about, you know, Cyclops, or you're talking about Hydras, or if you're talking about centaurs, or you're talking about Pegasus, or if you're talking about lion men, and on and on and on and on, that these may not just be fanciful imagination. It was either created by angels cohabitating with other animals to create them, or there's a DNA technology that's going on to create these other violations against corruption. And that's why it says the whole earth was corrupted, not just the violence, the whole earth, the animals, the plants. And I think that's why God calls the animals by, you know, species. Not every animal on the world is represented, just their species on the ark, because he knows which ones haven't been corrupted. And so I call that the greater Nephilim concept that was going on. And so not only have you got the copulation, but you've got other types of human crossbreeding with animals and other things and angels going on in the antediluvian epoch. Well, we're very close to doing that today through DNA manipulation and transhumanism and other aspects that are going to create other similar type of things in that Nephilim concept, which they call today the new man in the occultic societies, just as that's what the Nazis were trying to do as well.
When you talk about DNA manipulation, I still am so surprised about how many people, when you talk about it to them, they look at you like you have 10 heads. You know, there's actual articles out. I think the Huffington Post has written about DNA manipulation with them growing human organs and pigs and things like that. Like that's now today. That's actually happening. And there's a lot of people that theorize what is actually going on at CERN. And I know that's a whole different bag, you know, that I'm sure you could probably talk about for,
oh, yeah,
for
that's
a long
a show
time
in itself. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, maybe down the road we can do that show, because, you know, you hear a lot of different things coming out about CERN and stuff. And, you know, it's fascinating to think about what maybe they're actually what's going on there, but there are a lot of, hidden things that are right in front of your face if you know what to look for, such as, I think it's what the goddess Shiva in their logo, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and you know, Shiva is one of those gods of the underworld, and just as you have a god of the underworld in all the pantheons around the world, and they're the same pantheon, it's just different vernacular names. So you can use Mot or Nergal out of the Sumerian mythology, or you can use Apollyon out of the Greek mythology, which is reason why that is recorded in Revelation 9 as Abaddon in Hebrew or Apollyon in Greece, because this is one of the main leaders of the Watchers, or the Gregori, or the Anunnaki, whatever you want to call them in prehistory, that created these demigods, who is locked away in the abyss today. And so where the name CERN comes from is basically two different gods that are representing a similar type of god to the gods that I just mentioned, which are Cernunnos, which is a druidic god of the woodlands. And also in the Etruscan pantheon, it's known as CERN without the unos. It's just C-E-R-N. And he is also the god of the underworld and a woodland god, just as the Pan god is out of Greek mythology as well. And just as all of these gods who are these gods of the underworld are related in that sort of manner. So, and those are also seemingly connected back to Azazel, which Enoch will talk about as being the leader of the Watchers.
You know, kind of rewinding here a little bit, I wanted to ask you this question, and I just kind of looked over it. When it comes to these megalithic structures, I personally believe that the Nephilim were very much involved in building these things. I know a lot of people think that maybe it was aliens or some kind of some kind of forgotten technology that mankind had. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's two types of structures. One is ones that were built by the fallen angels or the gods before the creation and the domestication of humans. And in most accounts is that people will say most of these great cities were built by the gods. After that, though, you have this knowledge being passed on to humans where they are going to create their own megalith structures as a representation of their great civilization before the flood, as a memorial to how far that technology, and in this case, masonry, which is the fifth science or geometry, but called masonry inside the craft, is used to memorialize not only the ancient society, but to build these terrific megaliths in honor of their pantheon of the gods. Now, the question gets to be is were the giants used as the manual labor to build that? Perhaps, and I think there's some traditions that will suggest that, but those were mostly enslaved giants that were doing it and reporting to the kings of these civilizations who were also Nephilim. But it has more to do with, I think, the kings that are working with the polytheist religions to develop the technology of the sciences that I talked about earlier that come out with the ability to produce these great megaliths. And so I think they sponsor it. I think there's some giants being used as manual labor, but I think it's the level of technology that they developed before the flood.
How do you equate that level of technology then to the global scale when we find, you know, pyramids throughout the world? Do you think that this was at one time in our ancient history something that was more? I guess I don't know how to phrase this right, but maybe humanity, mankind, or whoever was building these things were more spread throughout the world than we would like to think, as far as communication goes.
I think so, because you have on every continent around the world, for the most part, a recollection of these giants. Well, for the giants you have on all continents, you also have that same story of the flood, in that the giants were the ones who caused the flood, with how they led the world and corrupted the world to cause this destruction, either by the God of the Bible or gods in the pantheon, depending on which perspective you're coming from on that. And what goes along with it is things like pyramids showing up in almost all of these civilizations that have similar sacred geometry and similar math to build them. Some are larger than others, but they all have a very similar sacred geometry. And they all have a dating that does not line up with what secular science and education would have us believe, even in the face of obvious testimony against it from the peoples and from things coming down through history, where we have records of the pyramids well before Khufu in 2300, that, you know, to around the time of 3000, and that they were built even before that. So that puts them well before the flood. So it's one of those things where when you have so many commonalities of the same pantheon, the same story, the same catastrophe, the exact same story of the creation and how the world becomes corrupt and how the giants rebel, in on and on and on and on and on, it is mind-boggling to suggest that that's coincidence. And I would suggest that that would go past very quickly if you calculate the odds and permutations past mathematical zero, which is 1 in 3.5 trillion to 4 trillion.
Wow. Yeah, those are some odds. So I wanted to ask you this question too. I'm kind of wrapping things up here, but there's two questions I wanted to ask you, and I don't feel like they really go together. So I'm just going to fire them at you. The first one here, fallen angels. Now, I've heard people say that they're locked away. I've heard people say that some are locked away and some aren't. What are your thoughts on where the fallen angels are today?
Well, it's a combination. According to Jude, only the ones that left their habitation to violate the laws of creation in Jude 1:6 are actually in the abyss. And so you might want to expand that to maybe the worst of the demons some additional bad angels, but certainly not all of them. What we do know is that some of these, many of them, by the sounds of it, in the greater number, are still active today, degraded in what they look like, degraded in stature, just as Hail El, which is the Hebrew for what the secret societies would like to call Lucifer, translation of 14:12 Isaiah, is degraded from the greatest being and a cherubim and seraphim to a Satan status. So they're all degraded in stature and how they look in the physical world. And whether or not they're still permitted into heaven, I think some of them are. Certainly in Job, we see of angels, not the degraded ones, but Satan going into the throne with other angels to present himself to God. And certainly in Revelation 12, we have angels that are warring with God in heaven. So they have somehow access to heaven. How large for the fallen ones, we don't know. But not all of them are in the abyss. That's the important point. And they're still here doing evil, just as the demons are working with them.
Right. And, you know, I heard a story recently, and I'm not going to be able to remember all the details, but this person told me that this story was relayed to him through email, that this guy was, I guess he was put in a mental institution because they thought he was crazy, and he wanted this person's opinion on what he thought this guy was going through. And apparently this guy was saying he was hearing voices in his home. He lives by himself, I'm assuming. And he would actually see these entities in his home talking about things about the flood and before the flood, and the way the guy was describing it in the email, he didn't know what these angels or these entities were talking about. But when I heard the story and I was talking to this guy, a lot of the things this person was describing sounded like either it was fallen angels or demons that maybe were Nephilim at one time that this guy was experiencing. But a lot of the details were straight like out of the biblical narrative. And I was thinking, and this guy has no clue about the whole biblical narrative. He had no idea what he was saying when he was telling this person this stuff. But he experienced such a extreme encounter that was ongoing. I'm trying to get the guy on the show to share his account because it's absolutely fascinating. But from what I understand, he's really standoffish when it comes to talking about this because it was so serious to him.
Right.
And go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to mention two things to that. One is I should also mention as another backup reference to which angels are in the abyss. Look to 2 Peter 2:4, where the angels who sinned in the days of Noah were locked away in the dungeon as well. And it's what's important to understand here about angels and demons and who he may be talking to is, and we get some of this in the Bible where demons will possess a human, especially, you know, the famous one is Legion out of the New Testament that lots of horror stories or movies are made out of and narratives. But they tend to contort and they're not a friendly host, and it's almost designed to ruin the human, but they seem to want to possess, because when they're not in a human body, according to what Jesus said, is that they're just wandering the earth with this endless thirst for a body. So they're looking to possess. But an angel or a fallen angel, I should suggest, does more of an avatar concept, which again is another occult term, but that's where they control a body, but it's not this violent sort of takeover, and somehow they do it a little bit differently, and the body doesn't become deformed, and you don't get this demon look, and your head's not spinning around in circles and stuff like that. So there's a couple of different sort of concepts on there, and we get that avatar concept that is not in that many applications in the Bible, but certainly when Satan is in the Garden of Eden and he avatars or coaches the Nakash, the serpent, to deceive Eve, I think it's an avatar, but that's my speculation.
Okay. Yeah, you mentioned about Legion, and I just find it funny. I always tell people that, you know, if you want a real good story, just go to the Bible, because a lot of the movies that are made today are, you know, some form of stories that came out of the Bible. Like the whole Legion thing, it's referenced throughout all Hollywood, and that's straight out of the Bible. So I always find that funny.
Well, and again, where it says in the King James Bible, where it says devils, that'll go back in those stories to the word, you know, daemon, which is the bodiless spirit. And if it's a devil that is like a capital D, like in Satan, it goes back to diabolos. So again, two different entities are being talked about here.
Okay. All right. So my last question for you, Gary, and this is a question that I know a lot of my audience is going to want me to ask, because a lot of my audience is very much into the cryptid side of things. This is a suggestion that always comes up. Do you think the whole idea of Bigfoot, Dogman, these kind of cryptids are forms of Nephilim?
I think if they're real, and I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that it is, that these are what I was talking about earlier as part of this greater form of the violations against the laws of creation before the flood and survivors thereof, and or the greater Nephilim concept, because they all have the same correlation. So let's take Bigfoot, for example, right? So it's a larger, hairy type of being. The Horim are cave dwellers and known to be hairy, and Nephilim were known to be hairy beasts. So you have some sort of relationship there, but I think Bigfoot's a little bit different, even though the Horim were cave dwellers. But in the Bigfoot mythos, they tend to have this ideology that they go between the dimensions through the portals in the caves, which again is very common sort of understanding in occultism with portals. But they have a commonality of association and location and similarities that are hard to deny, just as you can put Bigfoot, Nephilim, and little people together, as in the elementals. And there's three different kinds of elementals, which, again, we don't have time to go into in terms of the four classifications of fairies and all the three classifications of the smaller fairies. But they all work hand in hand in sightings, locations, and throughout history.
Okay. Yeah, because I always ask that question, and I always get that question from people. And it's one of those things where, you know, I kind of go both ways on. I could see it. Now, I guess my last question, my exiting question would be, if they were Nephilim, would you suggest people to continue looking for them?
Well, I don't think they're specifically Nephilim. I think they're other reprobate beings created by the fallen angels and the followers thereof, and somehow they survived the flood, same way that the Nephilim did. I would not encourage people to pursue them too readily, because you don't know what's going to be attached with it. You don't know what demon spirits might be there with them. You don't know what other fallen angels might be there with them. But I know that's not going to deflate people's curiosity, and I have just as much curiosity about it as other people, and I would love to know whether or not for sure they're real and there's 100% certainty in if they're intelligent beings or not. But everything suggests that they are intelligent beings and that they were created in prehistory, just as one example would be the gray aliens. I would mix in that same sort of context, because in fairy mythology, they go back into prehistory. This is not in the Bible. This is outside the Bible. I want to state that for clarity. But there's one particular fairy that comes out of the gnome classification of the three classifications of the elementals, which are ugly looking smaller fairy beings. And these ones look after the genealogies and they look after the technology from the Nephilim. So again, there's always connections back to Nephilim and to the gods because they're created by the gods. And they serve the demigods in this earth. And they seem to have these flying machines in fairy mythology, and they come through portals or shays or fairy mounds or fairy domens. And a fairy domen is like a Stonehenge, mini Stonehenge type of rock formation that are all around the world, noting that domen stands for portal. And in the Scottish tradition, these little gray neighbors, as they like to call them, and just grays in other fairy mythology, they would kidnap people in these flying machines for a fortnight and do scientific experimentation on them, always sort of designed to somehow procreate or things that they needed to continue to survive, and then they would return them back after a fortnight. I give a description in my book about a fairy, an exact quote and a story of a fairy abduction, and if you didn't know it was a fairy abduction, you'd swear it was a gray alien abduction.
Wow. Gary, you're a wealth of information, and I would love to have you back on the show sometime. Where can people get your book at?
Well, I would come back anytime you invite me, Tony. So anytime we can hook up again, let's do it again. And you can find my book on most online retailers, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, Books a Million, you name it, they all carry it. You can also order it through your local bookstore if you want to support your local bookstore, because it's distributed by Bookmasters out of Pennsylvania. So they can order the book in for you if it's not on the shelf. You can also go to my website, the Genesis6Conspiracy.com, Genesis6Conspiracy.com. That's with the number six. And you can read a generous excerpt of all 98 chapters on the book if you want to get a good feel for it. You can order a signed copy from me if you would like that. And you can also connect into both Amazon and Barnes & Noble off that website and into the Kindle format. If people want to follow me at all or get a hold of me, you can get a hold of me through the website or on Facebook under Gary Wayne. And I also have two Genesis 6 conspiracy pages, and I also do work on the Giantology page that's out there as well. And I also have a Facebook group called Gary Wayne, the Genesis 6 Conspiracy Group. And you can also get a hold of me or follow me on Twitter at GaryWayne63, at GaryWayne63. If you have a question, I will get back to you. And if I can add anything to a comment that you just want to send to me, I will get back to you on that as well.
Great, Gary. I really appreciate you being on tonight, and thank you very much.
Well, happy to be here, and hoping the audience liked our discussion, and hopefully it raises their curiosity and dig a little bit deeper, because that's the whole point.
Absolutely. All right, take care.
Thank you.
Well, that's the show, everybody. I really hope you enjoyed it. And if you did enjoy it, leave a rating review on iTunes for your chance to win a gift in the mail plus a shout out on next week's show. A couple of things I forgot to mention earlier. One, many of you sent me emails asking me what happened next, as in what happened after that encounter with the warlock that I had. Well, I have delivered to where he works since then, but I have not delivered there since I've connected all the dots as to what happened that day. And I was pretty ticked off once I realized what happened. So next time I see him, I'm going to be confronting him as to what happened that day. And I'll let you guys know how that goes when I find out. And next week, we'll be right back here on The Confessionals. But until then, stay safe out there, friends.
All my friends are heathens, take it slow. Wait for them to ask you who you know. Don't know.
freak show sitting next to you. You left some weird people sitting next to you. You think I did not get here sitting next to you. But after all I've said, please don't forget. All my friends are here to take it slow. Wait for them to ask you who you know. Please don't make any sudden moves. You don't know the hassle of the abuse. All my friends are here to take it slow. Wait for them to ask you. Why'd you come? You knew you should have stayed. I tried to warn you just to stay away. And now they're outside ready to bust. It looks like you might be one of us.
Hey everyone, this is Carrie Champion, the host of Naked Sports.
When you sit behind the wheel of the all-new 2025 Nissan Armada Pro 4X, you'll feel like the entire world is your playground. And you'd be right, because this unshakable fortress of a vehicle is built to take you on your next adventure. With a twin-turbo V6 engine, the all-new Armada is powerful enough to take you anywhere. With its 8,500 pounds of towing capacity, it will let you bring all your toys along. And with seating for eight, your whole crew can join you. Nissan created a truly capable vehicle in the all-new Armada. In fact, it's the first Armada to earn the Pro 4X badge, which Nissan reserves for its most adventure-ready vehicles. The Armada is a big SUV designed and built for big adventures and must be experienced to be appreciated. Drive the all-new 2025 Nissan Armada today. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. Intelligent four-wheel drive cannot prevent collisions or provide enhanced traction in all conditions. Always monitor traffic and weather conditions.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry! These July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location while supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
You know, if you can find the joy in the small moment, life will always be that much more fun. That's what Hello's oral and personal care products are all about. They take the mundane of every day and inject it with some everyday yay. Take Hello's anti-plaque and whitening fluoride-free toothpaste, for instance. It will brighten your routine and delight your senses with a formula that's equal parts fresh, friendly, and has plaque-fighting power. Or see the difference that a whitening toothpaste powered by vitamin C can do for your smile with Hello's Vitamin C Whitening Fluoride Toothpaste. With thoughtful and fun products that can make brushing your teeth feel like a confetti-filled bathroom dance party. So say hello to happy, to making the most of every moment. Say hello to a vegan, cruelty-free, and never tested on animals toothpaste. And say so long to dyes, parabens, artificial sweeteners and flavors, and other things you can do without. Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances. And get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Does Friendly have a taste? If it does, it's probably like Hello's peppermint-flavored anti-plaque and whitening toothpaste. Brush away plaque, show tartar who's boss, and remove surface stains to naturally whiten. Hello's thoughtful and flavor-forward products make brushing your teeth feel like a confetti-filled bathroom dance party. So say hello to Hello with the always cruelty-free, never tested on animals toothpaste that's made to spread smiles. Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.